Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us David Kirby on the line. We're going to be talking about his new book, which incidentally we are carrying. It's called Evidence of Harm, Mercury and Vaccines in the Autistic Epidemic, a Medical Controversy. Mr. Kirby, thank you so very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, I think you've done a tremendous job and a tremendous service by writing this book. So how did you get interested in this problem?
Well, I knew nothing about this until November of 2002, when Congress passed the Homeland Security Bill, which I certainly supported. I live in New York City, and I witnessed 911 myself. The next day, I realized that there had been a rider inserted into the bill secretly that would have dismissed lawsuits against Eli Lilly and vaccine makers for having put this mercury-based preservative called thimerosal into vaccines given to children. And I thought it was an unusual move and worth investigating.
And now, of course, what did the mercury in the vaccines have to do with Homeland Security?
Well, that was the question I asked myself. The answer is actually bioterrorism. It's kind of a roundabout connection, but vaccine makers who may one day be called upon to produce, unfortunately, anthrax, smallpox, etc. type vaccines, were also looking for litigation protection for having put thimerosal into vaccines in the past, and to try to group all vaccines together into one class as a anti-bioterror agents.
But of
a lot of people thought that they should be separated out.
And of course, basically, this is something that Senator First, who really serves the pharmaceutical industry, and today is the of course, the Speaker of the Senate, or the Majority Leader in the Senate, certainly Dr. First had actually been trying to get this legislation through for a long time to protect Eli Lilly. And wasn't this really all about protecting them really from liability for what they had done to so many children?
Well, the bill as written, and it was actually rescinded shortly thereafter, but when it was passed, the language would indeed have dismissed all lawsuits against Eli Lilly and other vaccine makers, and there were some that had been filed in court, and potentially thousands and thousands of more coming. The language that was inserted into the bill, into the Homeland Bill, was lifted directly from a bill that Senator Frist had written the year before and failed to pass. Whoever copied it, took it from his bill, sent it over to the Republicans, and Representative Dick Armey, the majority leader at the time, slipped it in at the last minute.
And, of course, he defended what he did, said he'd been told to do it by the White House, but everybody at the White House denied telling him to do it.
That's correct. And then...
Was Dick Armey lying, or were they lying in the White House?
Well, I can't answer that question. Dick Armey later retracted that statement and said that he acted alone out of concern of protecting the nation's vaccine supply.
I see. Or was pressure put on Dick Armey? Because actually, right after that, he resigned from the House.
Well, he was already set to resign,
right.
So he was outgoing when he did that.
All right, fine.
But he did take... credit for having put it into the bill.
I see. Well, but basically, of course, they stuck this into the bill in the middle of the night so no one would know it was there. Wasn't that done very surreptitiously?
Extremely so, and I would even venture to say undemocratically. Most members of Congress did not know it was there. Among them, Representative Dan Burton, a conservative Republican from Indiana.
Hold that thought right there, please, David.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is David Kirby. He's written a very provocative and a very important book. It's called Evidence of Harm, mercury in vaccines and the autistic epidemic a medical controversy. And what you have to understand is that autism was some years ago in the 1980s a very rare disease. And then, what was it, about 1990 or so, it began to increase and increase dramatically from 1 in 10,000 children to 1 in about 166 children. And, of course, it's said that actually 1 in every 5 American or 6 American children today has either a neurodevelopmental or a behavioral problem. Is that right, David?
That's correct.
All right. Well, then, of course, as you began to study this, and you found many of the parents were firmly convinced it was the autism and, pardon me, it was the mercury in the vaccines that had created this problem because their children were normal until, of course, they got their vaccines and suddenly began to regress. So why don't you pick up the story?
Sure. It really is the story of a small handful of parents who began suspecting mercury shortly after the government announced in 1999 that children were being exposed to levels above the EPA safety limit in those vaccines. These parents on their own began researching mercury toxicity and what the signs and symptoms were of those various different diseases, because there's no one single form of mercury poisoning. And they found that some of the symptoms were extremely similar to what was going on in their children, who, like you said, had been born perfectly normal, progressed and met all their normal developmental milestones, walking, talking, affection, eye contact, etc., and then withdrew from the world. These parents then found each other through the internet, which was still pretty new at the time, and at least for them, and they kind of put two and two together and came up with this theory that thimerosal is at least one contributing factor to the autism epidemic, and is what occurred in their children, who, by the way, are almost exclusively boys.
And so this is something that involves primarily boys, and of course, when it, 1 in 166 children, what is this, about 1 in 40 or 50 boys? That is much more frequently in boys.
Yeah, for some reason, I'm told the math comes out to 1 in 80 boys, and right. I'm not quite sure why, but that's still astounding. Regardless.
And of course, these parents were trying, of course, to get to the bottom of this and trying to get treatment. What was so discouraging was just about 6 weeks ago, with this massive blitz through the media, Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine, U.S. News World, almost as somebody had given instructions. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this afternoon is David Kirby, his book, Evidence of Harm, and I was just commenting that it was about 6 weeks ago why it was almost as if somebody had given an order, and every one of the major news magazines and every major newspaper and certainly every one of the television networks were coming out talking about autism. Suddenly they're all saying the same thing, and there's no treatment for it other than, of course, behavioral modification. And certainly, although some people think it's the mercury, why the government assures it isn't the mercury. Why don't you pick up and tell us what we really know about the relationship between mercury and autism, or tell the story as you want to, because you know the story better than I do.
Sure. Well, it's a very long book, so there's a lot of stories in it. Again, going back to the similarities between different forms of mercury poisoning that have been studied in history and the symptoms of autism, you have things like Mad Hatter's disease, and Mad Hatters were exposed to mercury vapor in the felt-making process and would do things like withdraw socially, become irritable, lose eye contact, have gastrointestinal problems, etc. A really interesting case was in the early 20th century, something called pink disease or acridinia, which resulted from mercury in the teething powder given to children. Now, those are infants that are older than newborn babies getting injected. It's a different form of mercury and a different route of exposure. The common symptom in those children, and by the way, only 1 in 500 children exposed to the mercury came down with the disease, which strongly indicates a genetic predisposition to be, let's say, hypersensitive to mercury toxicity. These children developed red, weepy rashes on their skin and the hands and feet, which gave the disease's name, but they also developed rocking, repetitive behaviors, self-injurious behaviors, lack of eye contact, loss of speech, loss of sleep, withdrawal from social situations, many of the classic signs of autism that we see. So that, again, gave the parents the idea that possibly some cases of regressive autism were in fact induced by mercury exposure, almost certainly with a genetic predisposition in a minority of children. Since that time, and really in the last year, there's been a lot of biological evidence produced in the clinic, in laboratory models, in animal models, and in the test tube that would indicate a few things. That children with autism have a predisposition to not be able to excrete heavy metals to which they are exposed. As opposed to the general population, typical people have... humans have evolved over the centuries with natural defenses against mercury and lead and other metals. And it comes in the form of certain sulfur-based proteins and amino acids. Believe it or not, it's all about how much sulfur you have in your system. And these children have been shown that they cannot produce these sulfur-based proteins. And when they're exposed to heavy metals, that would then trigger certain reactions where the metal cannot be excreted, and it actually causes damage to certain metabolic pathways, and we're finding out it gets into the brain. So that's the basic premise of the theory. Most of the evidence to support the theory has been biological, toxicological, etc. The evidence presented against the theory, and I do want to stress this is still theoretical and unproven. I also want to mention that mercury has largely been taken out of childhood vaccines, except for the flu shot. But throughout the 90s, most children were being exposed well above EPA limits. On the other side, with data produced largely by the government and researchers in Europe, that has mostly been large epidemiological studies, hundreds of thousands of children, computerized data, that, even according to the authors, were not designed to find these small sets of children that might be susceptible to something like mercury toxicity.
But can we trust the government studies?
Well, that's not my call.
All right, fine. Then I won't ask you to do that. But there has certainly appeared to be almost a conscious effort on the parts of certain people in government not to be entirely forthcoming about this. And I'm sure you're well acquainted with this study, that this meeting they had, I think it was Georgia in 1999 or 2000.
June of 2000.
Why don't you go ahead and perhaps cover that? Because this certainly suggests that there were people who had actually seen the government's own statistics, knew that they suggested that there was a definite causal relationship between receiving the vaccines with the mercury in it, and they did nothing about it.
That's right, and the data, there was suggestions there. I wouldn't use the word definite myself, just in defense of the researchers who were there. The data were provocative and disturbing, and I think everybody in that room realized it. This was a two-day conference held outside of Atlanta at a private retreat called Simpsonwood, and it's quite apparent by reading the transcript that the people there never imagined that their words would be written down and distributed to the public.
In fact, wasn't this even almost classified and intensely suppressed so the public couldn't get hold of it?
It was only obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, as were many of the internal documents and emails that these parents obtained. Thank God that we have the Freedom of Information Act in this country, otherwise the story never would have come out, I imagine. One of the documents that they obtained were the minutes to this meeting. It was a top-secret, invitational-only meeting held by the CDC with members of the FDA and the American Academy of Pediatrics and the vaccine makers and other public health officials, where the lead author of the CDC study, the man who was looking into our own version of this computerized data, looking at children enrolled in HMOs, and he did find statistically significant increases in risk for a variety of outcomes with different exposure levels of thimerosal. This was, as he said, still preliminary data. This, by the way, was this study was already in its third generation of analysis by the time he presented at this meeting, and the risk for all the outcomes had come down, especially autism had come way down. But he was not just discussing autism, he was discussing ADD, ADHD, tics, speech delay, language delay, etc. And when he combined all these, including autism, into an umbrella category called neurological developmental disorders, the risks were extremely elevated, and they were statistically significant, and they were what they call linear, meaning for every increment in exposure to mercury, there was a relative increase in risk for the outcome, which is pretty, let's just say, significant and disturbing, and the people at this meeting were very concerned. Unfortunately, most of them were concerned about lawsuits, as you read the transcript.
Well, a couple of them were concerned, though. They didn't want their grandchildren to get this, and they even expressed that. We don't want this for our grandchildren.
Yes,
we're not going to do anything about it for the rest of the folks.
Well, yes, one of the participants said, I just went out in the hall and got a call. My grandson was just born, blah, blah, blah. And there's no way that that child is going to receive a thimerosal-containing shot until we get to the bottom of this. But then, of course, he voted to keep it secret and voted to... They knew they had to release this information. They were trying to figure out how to best couch it and present it to the American people. By the way, when they did it, it was at 4:15 on a Friday afternoon in July in Washington, D.C., which, as everyone knows, that's when official Washington dumps its very most dismal news. And sure enough, the media did not pick up on it.
And, of course, this is done specifically so that nobody will ever find out what's really being said. In other words, that's the time when it doesn't get a play in the news, and it certainly is not then disseminated across America.
Yeah, Friday afternoon in July is not a good time to make news.
Oh, okay, so then what happened after that? My understanding is that eventually this was written up a medical journal, but it wasn't written up quite the way that that it was presented at the original meeting?
That's correct. I mentioned that the data presented at the meeting was already the third generation of analyses. There was a fourth generation presented a year later at the Institute of Medicine when these risks had dropped even further, mostly due to stratification of the data, in other words, breaking them up into individual HMOs, breaking the children up into individual exposure categories, and adding in new children into the study, including large numbers of younger children who would not yet be old enough to have an autism diagnosis. And the argument is that this would tend to, quote-unquote, water down the data and bring down the risks. By the time the study was published in the journal Pediatrics in November of 2003, they had stopped looking for autism altogether, and they found slightly elevated risks for tics at one of the HMOs, elevated risks for speech delay at one of the HMOs. Though those outcomes were statistically significant, but they couldn't find similar outcomes in the other HMOs, so they were not consistent. So the general conclusion was that we found no evidence of harm. Now, when the Institute of Medicine looked at this study the following February and then issued their report last May, their report was rather conclusive and said the body of evidence argues against the causal association and basically we should stop looking at mercury and go look elsewhere. The main author of the study that was published, who, by the way, that day at the Institute of Medicine in July of 2001, that morning, he announced that he had been hired to go back to his native Belgium to take a job at vaccine maker GlaxoSmithKline.
In other words, he was going to leave his position with the CDC, and now he'd be representing the vaccine manufacturer who faced lawsuits. How could he give an impartial analysis?
I don't know, but he did that morning. Now, he, to his credit, and I believe that he's a good scientist and wanted to do good science and possibly got caught up in American vaccination politics, which are pretty rocky. He published a letter in Pediatrics last year saying, you know, I don't quite understand what all the fuss is about. This was a neutral study. It did not show an association, it did not show evidence against an association, and more study is needed. But you don't hear the CDC mentioning that letter when they refer to the study as proof of no evidence of harm or you know, evidence of no harm.
Right, that sounds like sort of a double negative, which comes out to do nothing but confuse people.
Well, it's very hard to prove a negative, I will right. say, in their defense. Oh. And it's very hard to prove any substance 100% safe.
We'll be back in just a moment. A very important book is called AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic. Actually, it's a book I wrote back in 1991 that tells you the story of the politics of the AIDS epidemic and the fact that doctors have been blocked at every turn from doing what was really necessary to stop the spread of this horrible plague, both in the United States
and throughout the world. AIDS, the unnecessary epidemic, it gives you my story of my effort working with an organized medicine. The fact that the doctors of the state of California consistently voted and supported an effective public health policy, and at every turn their efforts were frustrated by those working with an organized medicine, both at the state and national level, and the tragedy is that people are dying in America today unnecessarily. Call 1-800-5-HIV-1 and ask for AIDS, the unnecessary epidemic, because you need to understand the background of this epidemic to understand what is really happening medically in America today.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In the 1970s, there was a group of Italian immigrants in the small town of Roseto, Pennsylvania, who drew worldwide attention for their unusual cardiovascular health, despite their pasta diets. I recently uncovered the fact that their unusual health was attributed to the precious red wine which they imported from Italy. Today we know this as the French paradox, the fact that the French exhibit greater cardiovascular health, despite their fatty diet, because of the red wine they drink. Wouldn't it be great to enjoy the health benefits of red wine without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives? Well, now you can with Longevinex, the world's first stabilized red wine molecules, preserved in an airtight capsule just like in a sealed bottle of red wine, equivalent to 5 glasses of the best red wine. Call 866-405-4000 to order Longevinex for healthy aging without the calories and alcohol. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done. Get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap. It's a miracle.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is David Kirby. His book, Evidence of Harm, and we do carry this because we think it's a very important book. Well, you start out the book really with some heartrending stories of the families that really have the autistic children. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about the impact of an autistic child on a family?
Boy, it's something that I had no idea about until I started doing this book. I really knew nothing about autism. I had never met an autistic child. I ignorantly thought they kind of sat quietly alone in the corner and took care of themselves. Autism, which is a spectrum of disorders, and when we say 1 in 166, that ranges from very severe to the more mild forms of the disease, like Asperger's and pervasive developmental disorder, which really are not that mild, believe me, in many cases. It is living hell for these people, and you really can have nothing but sympathy for them and admiration that they get up every morning and deal with this, and then that some of these parents, in addition to doing that, go out and fight for their kids, both legally and scientifically and medically, fight with their doctors, fight with the government, fight with the drug companies. It's, you know, I lived in New York through the whole AIDS experience, and I was working for the American Foundation for AIDS Research at the time, and the parallels are quite similar between, you know, these activists who admittedly were probably, you know, more street-based than these parents are, but I can see the passion and the fact that they're changing things like the doctor-patient relationship and the way that the public health establishment looks at a certain disease. But their lives are nothing that anybody would wish on anyone, and I say that knowing that they love their children immensely, and their siblings are really inspirational. These kids don't get as much attention as the autistic child in the family. They can't, and yet they are right there for them, which I really thought was great. But no, these kids live in physical pain. They have horrible GI problems. They try very hard to communicate and express their misery and often can't. The other thing that I didn't realize is that they will escape. They will get out of the house and run away unless you keep an eye on them. So most of the houses I visited had alarm systems and sealed doors and locks, and sure enough, even then, sometimes the kids would get out, and the whole family would have to fan out through the neighborhood and go knocking on doors until they found the child. So it's terrible.
Well, of course, the government insists that there is no relationship. The vaccine manufacturers insist there's no relationship between thimerosal and this, yet we're going to take it out of the vaccines anyway. Why would, if there was no danger, why would they take it out? If it was really necessary, why would they take it out? And if it was harmful, and they'd known it was harmful, and there were really no studies to show it was safe, why do they leave it in for so long?
Oh, boy, those are all very complicated questions. I would say the two biggest answers are money, or let's say the three biggest answers are money, convenience, and not wanting to alarm people or drive people away from vaccination or threaten the national immunization program. Let me try to take those one at a time. It's not necessary in vaccines. Vaccines that come in multi-dose vials do need a preservative, because every time you stick the needle in them, you might introduce harmful bacteria. Many vaccines have never been made with thimerosal, even in multi-dose vials. MMR, among them, that's a live virus preparation, and I believe they use a phenol-based preservative for that. It's not clear to me why they couldn't use a phenol-based preservative for these other vaccines. It's important to note that thimerosal has and still is used in the manufacturing process of vaccines. It's used to protect sterility in the product as they're making it in case bacteria got in, which is what happened with the flu shot last year, by the way, the Chiron shot. 45 million doses were contaminated with Serratia, even though that vaccine contained thimerosal in it. Serratia is resistant to mercury, and I think that's probably what happened over there. But anyway, because it was in the solution already, they left it in post-marketing as a preservative. And for many, many years, it wasn't, if it was causing harm, it wasn't being picked up. And it wasn't until the late 1980s when the mercury burden really started to go up, and then in the 90s, and it wasn't really until the end of the 90s, when the FDA was ordered by Congress to add up the total amount of mercury. And that's when the researchers realized that they had given kids way too much for an entire decade.
And, of course, what they were giving this to newborn children in the hepatitis B vaccine the first day of birth, or the very day of birth, for a disease that was of no danger at all to 99.9% of the kids in this country. And yet they were giving it anyway. And you have to ask yourself, why? We'll be back in just a moment to explore more of this incredible story.
Book that will really help you to understand the nature of the spiritual battle in which we're currently involved is Gary Kaw's book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism. Now, you may remember Gary Kaw's book, A Route to Global Occupation. His second book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism, goes into the very real spiritual forces, the dark and sinister spiritual forces, which have energized those people who are molding the world in which we live today. Going into the background of Masonry, Theosophy, and he actually quotes extensively from the writings of these people who have helped to mold the events of the 20th century. The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaw will give you tremendous insight into the background of what's happening in America today. And unless you understand the spiritual forces at work, you really can't understand the unfolding of events. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaw.
Leading-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
Have you ever wondered whether you're really getting the truth from the media? Have you ever thought that maybe somebody's controlling your reality? Well, there's going to be a meeting. It's going to be held at the Westin Hotel over by Great America. It's going to be on May 28th and 29th, and it's going to be at the Conspiracy Conference. Now, if you'd like to know more about the Conspiracy Conference, call 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. This is the fifth exciting year they've had this. Dick Gregory is going to be there, Nick Begich. There's going to be Daniel Hofsicker, Jack McLam. I'm going to have a booth, although I'll not be speaking. You're going to see really the contrast between good and evil. The Conspiracy Conference is a great educational opportunity. We hope that many of you will give serious consideration to going May 28th, 29th. That's 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999.
Are you concerned about your child's future? Well, it starts with a sound education.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is David Kirby, and we're talking about his book, Evidence of Harm. And we were simply asking that question, well, if there were no real good tests to show this was really safe, there were no tests to really show that it didn't do any harm. And, of course, here they're having all these children having problems, and they keep putting this in. And then, of course, eventually they said, well, we know it doesn't do any harm, but we're going to take it out. And the question is, if it didn't do any harm and it was necessary, why did they take it out? And, of course, if it did do harm, why did they leave it in for such a long period of time when the parents were clamoring and pointing out that this was, they believed at least, the cause of the terrible damage that was being done in this epidemic of autism and certainly neurodevelopmental abnormalities? And we've gone from, as Mr. Kirby says in his book, from one case of autism in every 10,000 children to about one in every 80 boys in America. So this is a dramatic change in everything. And then so many other children will have other of this spectrum of diseases, ADD and ADHD, and they can't read, or they can't talk, or they can't think, or other cognitive abnormalities. So pick up the story there, please.
Okay. Well, I guess first I would start by saying the FDA and the government did not take mercury out of vaccines because the parents were clamoring about it. The parents were unaware of it. It was the actual statement issued by the FDA in July of 1999 that alerted parents to this potential problem. the public health people would say we took mercury out to allay parental concerns and maintain confidence in the vaccine program, even though there is no evidence of harm. In other words, we're doing it because it sounds scary to people, so we'll make vaccines without it. I sort of take-home message they were giving. Subsequently, thimerosal has been undergone tests and studies and by people who both support the theory and refute the theory. And again, if you look at the biological evidence, there is more evidence of harm. And if you look at the government-produced studies, that would tend to dismiss any evidence based on these large population studies of computerized data.
All right. Well, now, of course, have you run into the Mark Geyer and David Geyer, his son, and their analysis of the CDC data bank?
Yes, I have. And they found they are the only people literally on Earth outside of the vaccine program who have been granted access to go in and look at the raw data. On the occasions when they went, they had a lot of trouble using the software and the interface programs and were not able to pull as much data as they would have liked. On the numbers they ran, they did find a highly elevated risk for autism among children who received mercury in their vaccines compared to children who did not, many, many times elevated. We now have this raw data sitting there. We have had government researchers go in there and look at it and run the numbers and come up with one result, which is virtually a null result. And then we've had the Geyers go in and look at it and come out with the exact opposite, with highly significant results. So I think we could settle this controversy in a matter of weeks or months by getting a third party in, some team of highly respected independent researchers with no ties to the story, who would not reveal the confidentiality of the patients. In fact, patient names are removed from the data anyway. Allow them free access to the data. Allow them to create whatever data sets they want and analyze them in any way they want. Have them come back out and publicly present their findings. Allow other researchers then to go and verify their findings and try to replicate their studies. And hopefully, you know, they would be able to say definitively one way or the other whether this has validity. And that could put this to rest.
But of course, if there's nothing to conceal, why is the CDC so intent upon not allowing people to have access to public records? Why have they classified the information? That doesn't make sense.
Well, they do sort of treat it like nuclear secrets, I have to admit. It's extremely difficult to get in to see that data. It took the Geyers 2 years of bureaucratic hoop jumping, if you will, and they did sign every paper and dot every I and cross every T and managed to get in. The CDC claims that you could upset the confidentiality of these patients and that if the patients knew that their data was being looked at by outside researchers, that the HMOs would not want to participate in this program. But again, the patient names are deleted, as are their date of birth. It'd be very, very hard to figure out the names of these patients, and what independent researcher going in there would want to do that anyway?
That really almost seems like it's a contrived justification for keeping this information a secret, and if there's nothing to conceal, then why conceal?
Well, if I could point out, there was another committee convened by the Institute of Medicine just recently to look into this issue of the sharing of data and of this particular vaccine safety data and allowing outside researchers to come in. And it's quite an amazing document, and it will soon be up on my website, evidenceofharm.com. Right now it's up at the National Academies of Sciences, I think it's iom.edu. If you go to the reports section and look under data sharing, they completely come down against the CDC and their vaccine program for not allowing outside researchers in to see this data. They suggest very strongly that they make this data much more accessible, and that they even suggest that the CDC issue travel grants to bring programmers in from the outside to look at this data. And they warn the vaccine program people that they should seek legal counsel because the original data sets constructed by this Belgian researcher, Thomas Verstraeten, have, quote-unquote, gone missing.
They've just sort of disappeared. They've just disappeared.
The official language of the consultant at the IOM hearing was that they were not archived in the standardized fashion. They were lost or destroyed. That is a violation of the Federal Data Quality Act. We pay for this data. The taxpayers have spent over $25 million to maintain this data. It's public record, and they lost it or destroyed it. And that is potentially a felony. And if one person can one day be identified as the person who deliberately lost or destroyed this data, we don't know if that happened, that's a federal offense. And they may one day face criminal penalties. And the problem is now we can't go back and replicate. No one can replicate exactly what Thomas Verstraeten did because we don't have the exact same groupings of children that he looked at. And, that's it. And again, the IOM committee suggested that these CDC people seek legal counsel.
And my understanding is actually that very, very recently they've all been fired or transferred elsewhere, and that Julie Gerberding has taken this all under her...
She separated out the division in the vaccine program that promoted vaccines and that also at the same time monitored vaccine safety.
But you know, that's the most amazing thing, David, is that not one word of that in the regular media, because I read 6 newspapers every day, and the only way I know about that is because I talked to David and Mark Geyer, the scientists who actually were allowed to go in only because of pressure from Congress. The CDC did not want anybody to see this, and actually I think it was almost demands from Congress and threatening to cut off their funding if they didn't allow outside people to go in and try to determine the truth.
Well, again, it was Dan Burton, Republican of Indiana, who got this started, and then Dave Weldon, Republican of Florida, who really carried the ball and kept on top of the CDC, and probably without his constant interventions, the Geyers would not have been able to get in. They have not gotten back in since, and we still have this unresolved issue of what's in there. What is in that data, and why don't we have a right to see it?
Well, you know, it is this hyper-secrecy on the part of the government. In fact, you mentioned this study that was done in 2000 there in Georgia. And really, they did not want anybody to know about this meeting of some 55 scientists when they actually got the Verstraeten figures initially. And my understanding is the only way they were ever able to find out what this classified secret document was, which was nothing more than a medical meeting of doctors and scientists, was to go with the information, Freedom of Information Act, and literally threaten the CDC to get the information. How can we have that in a free society?
Well, how can you have a rider inserted in the last minute that none of the lawmakers know is there? There are a lot of disturbing questions in this book. I'm unfortunately not the one to provide the answers. I'm the one to make sure they keep getting asked. But that's a really good question.
Well, I think
we are talking about medical issues here. This is not like we started out talking about vaccines as part of the national security apparatus, and that is true. And by the way, I believe that any company that makes smallpox vaccines in the country deserves liability protection because a small number of people might be injured. They should be covered. I have no problem with that. But again, going back to the secrecy, we're really not talking about national security. We're talking about the health of our children. And I think every parent and every citizen has a right to have access to that information. I don't think that's a radical statement, quite honestly.
Well, I think what you're doing is raising an awful lot of questions and hope that other people are going to insist on getting answers. And the parents...
That's precisely right.
And when you're thinking of maybe one in every 80 boys has one or another of this spectrum of disorders, we must have an awful lot of unhappy parents out there who feel almost helpless. What have you learned in your study about the availability of treatment? Because certainly the mass media 6 weeks ago, when they had that big propaganda program, the whole theme, underlying theme of the news magazines and of the television and of the newspapers was, oh, there's nothing that can be done.
Yeah. Well, again, being a journalist and not a doctor or a scientist, I am very loath to even be thought of as recommending treatments. I do not recommend treatments. I just report on what other people tell me.
Well, what have other people told you about?
Well, okay, the treatments that they told me about are highly experimental, unapproved, and may have dangerous side effects. And I really want to warn people that anything they do, they have to do with their physician and not to do on their own and to not listen to me. But please. But with all that said, there are more and more and growing reports, and I have now spoken to hundreds and hundreds of parents who have treated their children with biomedical interventions, and unfortunately, the earlier they start, the better the success rate seems to be. But and by the way, this is also done in addition to often behavioral therapy. So until we have rigorous clinical trials, real science to determine what works and what doesn't, this is all still speculation and anecdotal. But I know kids who have gotten better after their parents have treated them with what is called chelation therapy. That is an approved therapy for lead poisoning in adults. It's not approved for autism in children. But it's the introduction of those sulfur-based proteins I was talking about earlier that these children seem to lack, or amino acids. Sulfur binds with mercury and heavy metals and allows the body to excrete it from the system. And that's what chelation is. And a lot of parents and their doctors are now giving chelation therapy to the children. We know that children who have autism dump out far more mercury than control children do in clinically, you know, published trials. And now we're seeing that many of these children get better. And it would stand to reason if you have a toxin trapped in your body and you were able to remove that toxin, the damage that toxin is doing may subside. In addition to that, there's another treatment that some doctors are now using that is designed to sort of repair the metabolic damage that mercury may have caused, if you will. And the theory behind that is that mercury blocks this very, very important process called methylation. Methylation is necessary for proper gene expression, for DNA development, for nerve development, and also, by the way, for the production of these sulfur-based proteins that we're supposed to have to clear the body of mercury. It's very complicated, and it sounds like crazy, nutty junk science, but they are using methyl B12, an injection of methyl B12 and other substances, to sort of kickstart this cycle that has theoretically been blocked by the introduction of mercury, which has been shown in some children to improve methylation and improve the levels of these sulfur-based substances. And also, we're now seeing clinical improvement in some of these children. They are talking again. Many of them are actually losing their diagnoses. They're having their services taken away from them. When the parents bring them back a year later, the neurologist looks at the kid and says, "Gosh, your son must have been having a really bad day a year ago because I don't know why I gave him an autism diagnosis. The best I can do is ADD. So, you know, now this is anecdotal. It needs to be studied, and we need hard science to show whether this is, you know, going to work. It's not going to work in every kid. There are side effects. It's very expensive. You can't do it at home. You can't do it on your own. But I think it's worth looking into.
And for our listeners out there, we do have a list of specialists, the doctors who have given up their regular professions to treat this. They have been ostracized in many instances by the medical profession for daring to treat these children. And yet, if you talk to them, these children are getting better. So, or at least many of them are getting better. So I would certainly not give people this feeling of hopelessness. And certainly, I think, David, you were sort of encouraged, at least talking to the people and hearing their anecdotal description of what had happened.
Well, absolutely. And you don't want to give people hopelessness. You don't want to give people false hope either. You want to be reasoned and balanced. But I need to report what I've found. And many of the children in my book have undergone chelation therapy, and it's now going on over 2 years that I've known some of these kids, and I'm astounded at their progress. I mean, they're speaking in what they call paragraphs, and when they see you, they recognize you, and they say, "Hi, David, how are you?" And you have a conversation with them, and they look at you, and it's just unbelievable. You can't believe that this child could not speak just a few short years ago. And even when I met them a couple years ago, their speech was very, very sporadic, and there was no eye contact, and there was no sociability. And now they're turning into regular kids, you know. They're sassing back to their parents, you know, which is like music to their parents' ears. So,
well, tell me, what have you learned? You've done an exhaustive study. You've done a great book. I mean, it's a large book. It's got how many pages in it here now?
Well, with the index and the footnotes, it's 400 and something.
Right, 454, as I just, I peeked at the end of it. Anyway, what have you learned? What is the message you would like to leave with our listeners today?
Boy, we need to get to the bottom of this. We need to prove one way, or we need to get this discussion and controversy behind us. it's too divisive, and it probably is scaring parents away from vaccines, and I'm actually, you know, in favor of childhood immunization. But we need to find out, does thimerosal contribute to autism? If it does not, then what is causing these rates to go up as high as they are? If it does, I would say we need to get mercury out of vaccines altogether, especially vaccines going to the third world, which are contained the full amount. We need to use good science to find how to detoxify these kids. And we need to compensate these families. And I don't know how, I'm not a politician, but someone's going to have to craft a rational plan to pay for the care and treatment of these children, especially once their parents are gone.
Are we still sending it to the third world countries, the thimerosal vaccine?
Absolutely. And it needs to be addressed.
It sure does. And why would anybody do that if they thought there was even a possibility we're going to hurt these kids all throughout the world? David,
they don't believe there is a possibility, so that's the problem.
Thanks very much, David. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Have you ever wondered what really happened at Waco? Have you ever wondered if maybe the government was not giving you the full story? Well, there is the most amazing video. It's called Waco, the Rules of Engagement, 2.5 ripping hours of the story of a government onslaught under a group of peaceable people. Now, their religion may be different than yours and mine, but they were still Christians, they still believed in the Bible, and they believed that the government would one day become their enemy and destroy them. Well, Waco, the Rules of Engagement is a video that everybody who loves freedom should see, because the ultimate conclusion is the government did not want them to come out. The government did everything they could to keep them from coming out, to antagonize them, loud music, lights all the time, to totally create a situation where they could not think clearly or would respond normally. Waco, the Rules of Engagement, is currently unavailable through regular sources. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR right now.
Have you purchased or invested in gold and silver coins or bullion in the last several years? If so, you've most likely been taken advantage of. In a lot of cases, out and out lied to. There are several tricks of the trade in play in the precious metals and collector coin markets. This is especially true during a hot market. Although it doesn't take a savvy investor to avoid the pitfalls of unscrupulous coin and metals dealers, it does take some common sense and the knowledge of which questions to ask. The asset management professionals at Colonial Resources can arm you with a few simple questions to ask your current broker or coin dealer. To find out if you've been taken advantage of, or if you're thinking of investing, call Colonial Resources toll-free. 1-800-685-4042. The precious metals and collector coin markets are hot and definitely where the smart money is heading. But before you make a mistake that could cost you hundreds or even thousands of dollars, call the professionals at Colonial Resources. The call and the advice are free. 1-800-685-4042. That's 800-685-4042.
The Sound Education. VHM provides for that cornerstone of your child's future with a quality education founded on biblical principles. Our school sets high academic goals while developing moral standards. From preschool through eighth grade, your child is taught by experienced and credentialed teachers in all subjects, including our dynamic music program and state-of-the-art computer classes. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." For over 50 years, VHM Christian School has provided peace of mind to parents knowing their children are receiving an excellent education in a loving environment. VHM is located at 427 Capitola Road Extension in Santa Cruz. Won't you call us today at 475-4762? That's VHM Christian School at 475-4762. Doesn't your child deserve a chance to try VHM?
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is a terrible, terrible story. And of course, what's so difficult for anyone to believe or even think is that anybody would want to harm a child. And yet, if you read Bertrand Russell, page 50 of his book, The Impact of Science on Society, he tells us how by diet and injections and injunctions, we'll be able to mold the character of the children so that they'll be just what the people in authority really want. And then he goes on to talk how we have to, of course, not have most people having children, but we just need a certain 30% of the women to be fertile, so we'll have enough cannon fodder for the wars that we're going to fight. And remember, Bertrand Russell was one of the leaders of this whole move towards the New World Order. and the New World Religion. Well, you'll really want to get this book, and you'll perhaps be touched as I was reading about the tragic stories of these families whose lives were destroyed as the child's mind was destroyed by a poison that they were putting in the vaccines, and they knew it was a poison. And we have so much other information. The book Evidence of Harm, available from Radio Liberty. You need to get it. You need to get it if you know anybody who has a child with autism. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on mercury. And, of course, we're putting together a four-tape set that will go into autism as well. And we're working on that at the present time. And that will be available very soon. So the four-tape set on mercury is available. We have a video on mercury and mercury poisoning. And, of course, this excellent book, Evidence of Harm. They're poisoning our children. They're covering this up. Why would anybody do that? Ladies and gentlemen, there are evil people out there. I know I was at the CDC. 500,000 Americans have died of AIDS in an unnecessary epidemic. If you haven't read my book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, and I tell you about my visit to the CDC and dealing with the number one man there and in the division that was dealing with the AIDS epidemic, and as he looked at me and he said, "What am I to do? I know what needs to be done, but I'm caught in the middle. What should I do?" And he's asking me. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I'm just there trying to understand the insanity of what's going by. But I will tell you that there were other people there that were just totally evil. And after 3 days at the CDC, I was so glad to get away from there, because the people who were handling the AIDS epidemic knew exactly what they're doing. 500,000 Americans have died. Another almost 1 million are infected in an unnecessary epidemic. And if you haven't read my book, you need to get it, and you need to study it, and you need to understand that this is only half the issue. The other half is the book Emerging Viruses by Dr. Horwitz, that goes into the background of how this virus was actually created. And of course, you really want to get my video, Nundare Called It Genocide, where we actually go into the background of how we know that this virus was created, and we'll even send you the government document if you want to see it, by Dr. MacArthur's testimony before the House Appropriations Committee in 1969, saying we want $10 million so we can create a new organism. We want to create a new organism for which there will be no immune response. And, of course, some people think we shouldn't, because it's another method of mass killing. But we want the $10 million to do it. Ladies and gentlemen, why would anybody want $10 million to create an organism that could be used for mass killing? And 20 to 25 million people have already died throughout the world. Another 40 million are infected. And we're not doing anything to stop the epidemic. So the information is there. You need to get our four-tape set on population control. You need to get our video on population control. But let me urge you right now, such an important book, Evidence of Harm by David Kirby, who we just heard, a well-crafted, well-written book that will touch your heart. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-555-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our website, RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Of course, we ask you to seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family and helping us to meet the expenses of putting these programs on, and then pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until Monday at the same time, when we'll be with you again. May the Lord be with you.